Welcome to the Dermalorian Podcast from the Dermatology Education Foundation. Forever chemicals have been in the news this month as the EPA released new guidelines aimed at reducing their presence in drinking water nationwide. What are forever chemicals and what, if anything, do they have to do with dermatology? Dermatologist and derm faculty member Dr. Michelle Hurey took a crash course in forever chemicals when she faced a patient with an inexplicable contact allergy. It turns out the chemicals in the patient's firefighting gear were to blame. That sparked Dr. Hurey's quest to learn more about these concerning chemicals. Dr. Hurey shares what she discovered and discusses implications for diagnosing and counseling patients with skin diseases.
Let's talk about a little bit more in depth about what these chemicals are, the per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. And that actually includes something called PFAAs, so polyfluoroalkyl acids, as well as precursor agents that get turned into the PFAAs with biotransformation, whether it's pH, heat, sunlight, whatever it is, that it can actually change into one of the PFAAs. And if you want to think about anything that you come into contact with on a daily basis as to whether or not it could have a PFAS in it or a forever chemical, you'd probably be right. So in the 1940s, this was manufactured by 3M. And it was meant to resist water and oil and stains. And you know this as Scotchgard and Teflon. Okay, these were the initial original ones, which were the PFOA and the PFOS. And, you know, that was wonderful. They worked great because they are chemically and thermally stable. They also are highly mobile. And this is important in the water supply because it just kind of goes everywhere. And it's very, very unique in the properties that it has, which actually not other chemicals have these sort of both hydrophobic and lipophobic properties. Usually you have one or the other, but the fact that it has both is kind of what makes it a great thing of kind of balling up and resisting things like the water and the oil and grease. And so to date, we have over 9,000 of these PFAS compounds. Most of them are those sort of precursors that turn into the acids, but there's over 9,000. It's really, really crazy. And they have absolutely been linked to various diseases, especially the developmental abnormalities and cancers. The most important thing is the fact that they are persistent in nature, and these are why it's called forever chemicals. They don't break down with normal processes like heat and UV exposure, and they absolutely bioaccumulate within our bodies, within wildlife, within the food supply. So this is why it's so insidious. It can be up to, you know, 6-8 carbons more chain with a fluoride on top, and it is very strong. Look at that half-life. Look at the half-life of these guys. So 8 years, 5 years, this is within our body before it kind of passes through into the environment. And take a look at this in more detail when you have a chance. But, you know, forever chemicals, the PFAS, which are mostly through, you mostly get exposed through inhalation and ingestion, right? So breathing the air, drinking the water, eating the food. And it has a whole list of things that it can affect, and not just, you know, cancer, but a ton of different things in men and women and babies. The up to date, though, most people thought it was just inhalation and ingestion, when really the dermal contact, the exposure we get and the absorption through the skin actually may be a very significant thing, and that not a lot of papers have looked at. For us in general population, so we're not all firefighters, how are some of the ways that we are exposed to PFAS? Well, obviously drinking water is a big one. Food that we eat, even the air that we breathe, especially if we're near places that are producing these things, right? And so let's look at the water. So I am never really a fan of the EWG. I believe that they have an agenda, and there are a lot of fear mongering. But in this situation, I think they did a good thing where they went around the country and they tested PFAS levels in the water. And at the time that this was published, the EPA only had a 70 part per trillion limit on their PFOA and PFOS levels. They have since decreased them to 4. And so that's great, except who knows if that's ever going to really happen. But you can tell, kind of depending on where you live, you may have higher levels or lower levels in your water supply. But for this, the talk, for this talk, I really want to talk about the issues that you see in consumer goods. So what we're buying, using on a daily basis. This is really important for us in the exam room, right? This is the what do we care? Well, what we care, this is important. This is going to affect how we treat patients and how we manage them. So there's not a lot of papers talking about the role of PFAS in dermatology, and that is because there's not a lot of data as of yet. But looking at the data out there, then I really feel that we should be looking at their role in atopic dermatitis, in endocrine disruption, because we do have papers talking about the risk of diabetes, thyroid disorder, sex hormone disorder, whether it's menarche issues, menopause issues. And then we have issues, obviously, we know about with skin cancer, there can be a link. And then another one is decreased vaccine efficacy, which is actually very interesting to me. So we're going to look at that too. You've all seen these things in the media. And I actually, you know, when this first sort of hit, and this was after a big study came out, which I'll go after, there were go over. There were a lot of big dermatology accounts on social media that were really downplaying the role of forever chemicals and PFAS. And they kind of likened it to, oh, it's a new paraben. The problem with that is that, yeah, it's not a new paraben. It actually is way more insidious and detrimental than the parabens are. And I do think parabens have been kind of demonized and think there are some bad ones. But this is a whole other beast to deal with. And I really feel that we shouldn't just sort of play it off as nothing, and we should look at it a little bit closer. Very briefly, I want to talk about mechanism of action. This is kind of one of the main reasons why this is such a problem, is because these compounds actually kind of mimic fatty acids. And you can see it's very similar in the way that the compound looks, except instead of a carbon hydrogen, we have a carbon fluorine. But really, they're very similar and they can act very similarly as well. Now, I want to please keep this in mind. The exact mechanism is not known. These are kind of like here and there because I feel that, you know, it affects a lot of different things. There's not one pathway of how it affects us. So it's kind of all over the place in what it does. So let's look at this. So for the sake of this talk, I'm not going to discuss the kind of atopic march that has been found with PFAS exposure, but definitely there has been so issues with asthma as well. And this is due to the high IgE that they found in these patients with elevated levels in serum. It also has more of a mast cell activation through the induction of inflammatory cytokines and a transcription factor, NF-kappa-B. So in addition, PFAS will, through cytokines, affect the TH pathway. So maybe you have less of a TH2 response, which means that your B cell antibodies might be decreased, and you have more of a TH1 response, which this may be an issue with, like, say, atopic dermatitis, I'll talk about later. Directly, PFAS will decrease the IgM, T cell dependent antibody response, which is the issue with the vaccine efficacy. And through actual change of the receptor of PPAR alpha expression. That's how we get our issues with our metabolic and endocrine dysfunction, as well as tumorigenesis. And interestingly enough, actual epigenetic changes on cells themselves, whether it's DNA methylation, histone modification, microRNA expression, that can change the gene expression and then lead to issues downstream. So it's very interesting how it affects everything. And for us, let's talk about it. This is, if you read one paper, read this one. This is the one that kind of broke open everything. So they looked at about 230 different cosmetics out in wherever, Sephora, Target, whatever. And they looked at a proxy and they checked the fluorine levels, which kind of tell us a little bit as to how much of the fluorinated compound is in it. They found that half of these had fluorine, okay? So they took those and they realized that they needed to be tested further, right? So they took these 52% and they randomly took 29 of those products to check more of a targeted analysis, like looking at individual PFAS. So whether it's PFOA, PFOS, and because it can be a little bit expensive to look at all 230 of them. Interestingly enough, of the 52% of the products who had that had increased fluorine levels, only 8% of those had something listed on the ingredient list. And of the 29 products that they tested, targeted, only 3% of those had any sort of PFAS listed on the ingredient list. This was huge in that when they tested all these guys, they ranged the PFAS concentration ranged from 22 nanograms per gram up to 10,500 nanogram per gram. The average for each one was over 1,000 nanograms per gram. Please keep in mind, the EPA safe level now is 0.004 nanogram per gram. This is huge, especially when you consider the fact that you can absolutely have issues with dermal absorption, which we've seen in the firefighters, but this is more of a direct path, right? So if you put something on your eyes, it's going to go in your tear duct. It's going to go, you're going to inhale it if it's a spray or anything close to your nose, and you're going to eat it if it is a lip product. And by the way, the lip products had the most sort of number of PFAS, and most of the chemical or most of the products, the lip products had PFAS. They may not have been the highest. I think the 10,500 was long wearing foundation, but definitely the lip products had, you know, most of them had something in it. Okay. And that makes sense, right? So let's talk about that dermal absorption. If it doesn't have a direct effect by going in the mouth or the eyes, what about the dermal absorption? There aren't a lot of studies on this. This was a great review article kind of looking over all the different pathways of PFAS exposure and specifically dermal absorption. And they really list one study. And unfortunately, it was in 2012, but that was maybe when it was a bit more ethically acceptable to test on animals. In this study, where they looked at a segment, you know, they had skin, right? They want to look to see if a test compound got through the epidermis and down the dermis and would have gone into the blood supply. And so they use in vitro studies on mice where they actually put the sample on top and then they measured the serum concentration in the mice. And then they took full thickness and did in vitro testing, full thickness of the of mouse skin, as well as full thickness of partial, so epidermis and dermis, and full thickness skin where they actually kind of looked all the way down here to see if the product penetrated through. And they used human skin that was cut out from cosmetic surgery. And they found that the mice absolutely had elevated serum levels of PFOA when they had increasing concentrations put on the skin. And the same thing for the in vitro testing, both on the mouse and the human skin. And they found that the absorption rate, the total rate actually where a compound put on the surface of the skin made it either into the epidermis, dermis, and stayed there, or actually would have transferred all the way through into the blood supply with 69%. The amount of PFAS that was applied to the surface that actually just went straight through and didn't stay in the skin was 48%. So that is a huge percentage of chemical, so PFOA, PFOS, whatever the PFAS chemical is, getting into the intact skin.
That 2012 study Dr. Hury references appeared in Journal of Toxicology and Environmental Health. We'll get back to Dr. Hury's discussion of forever chemicals with a focus on skin diseases in just a minute. But first, in honor of Rosacea Awareness Month, this month's Dermalorian clinical clip features dermatologist and derm faculty member Dr. Linda Stein-Gold. She offers an update on topical treatment for rosacea.
Rosacea is actually really having an exciting time. We have some wonderful new treatment options, and we have some options that we wouldn't necessarily expect. And I think the one that would surprise pretty much everyone is that we have a encapsulated benzoyl peroxide. And you might think, huh, benzoyl peroxide for rosacea, that doesn't make sense. And you would think, sure, it doesn't make sense because we don't talk about benzoyl peroxide for rosacea. In the past, it's been way too irritating. A patient would put it on one time and that would be it because it would sting and burn. But with this silica encapsulation process, the drug is in these silica sheets or shells, and it allows for very slow and deliberate delivery of the medication to the skin. And we found that by using this medication once a day, we got about half of the patients with moderate to severe disease clear, almost clear. And what's interesting is not only does it not sting or burn, but when we look at the background redness and irritation of the rosacea patients, it actually improves with use. We don't see an irritation with use. We actually see it getting better from even the first application. So that's exciting. Changes the way we kind of think about treating rosacea.
Let's get back to Dr. Hury as she takes up the issue of PFAS and eczema.
Let's look at PFAS and atopic dermatitis. Is there a risk for it? And it absolutely is a possibility. There are a couple of studies. They looked at, this is prenatal. So we're looking at kids here. There are no studies in adults. And they follow these mom-newborn pairs where they have serum levels prenatal, as well as following them through for a couple of years and whether it is going to sort of correlate with increased risk of atopic dermatitis. And it absolutely did. The interesting thing, which I am not sure why, but it was only in female children in this study. The male children did not have a correlation. This study also looked at the same thing where they checked the serum level, and this was a four-year study, and they found that it also had an increased risk of atopic derm, but only if they had a second hit, if they had a GSTT1 issue, gene issue. And that gene will affect detoxification and clearance of reactive oxygen species. So there may be something where you have to have a genetic predisposition, and then the PFAS will cause an atopic derm. We already know endocrine disruption is a thing, and PFAS concentrations absolutely corresponded to increased FSH and decreased estradiol levels in pre and peri and postmenopausal women. And that really showed them, and it affects reproductive aging, menopause, ovarian dysfunction. And then what about PFAS in younger patients that maybe have an increased risk of PCOS? And absolutely, unfortunately, this was a retrospective study, but it did correlate with PFAS exposure, increasing the risk, the hazard ratio for developing PCOS. The same is found in thyroid issues. And this one looked at the kind of the older PFAS and the newer PFAS. So the older ones were longer carbon chains, the new ones are shorter carbon chains because 3M thought it would be safer. And in reality, the short chains are actually more detrimental. And this study found whether it was the old or the new, the thyroid dysfunction was there It was directly cytotoxic. It accumulates within the thyroid. It can actually change the weight of the thyroid. It interferes with hormone synthesis, thyroid peroxidase function, and iodine uptake. Unfortunately, in a lot of these cases that had hypothyroidism, sometimes the TSH was normal. So maybe you might have to check more than just the TSH on your patients who might have thyroid issues. Vaccines, absolutely. This is a great study in JAMA that looked at serum PFOA and PFOS levels in kids. And they found the higher the level in the serum, the lower the antibody response was for the typical childhood vaccines with everything else controlled for. And in this study as well, same thing. When you have increased PFOA concentration, your antibody response goes down. Okay, so this will definitely be an issue for long-term protection for patients that are getting vaccinated. So for us, our significance, you really need to consider exposure and things obviously like skin cancer, that's a given, but maybe atopic dermatitis, acne, our PCOS patients, menopausal dermatologic changes that we see. And I think menopausal medicine is definitely neglected in most of fields of medicine and potentially dermatology as well. Thyroid dysfunction. So our hair loss patients, our treatment-resistant acne patients, dry skin, and then all of our psoriasis patients who maybe are on immunomodulators or suppressive agents, maybe their vaccines won't be working very well if they're having a high PFAS concentration. These are some buzzwords to consider. Please kind of read through this. So most of the time, if you see wear resistant, water resistant, smudge proof, all this glass skin, be very careful. Even if they don't list it on the ingredient list, more than likely it will have some PFAS in it. Going forward, yes, absolutely. There are potential for regulations on this, whether from the EPA trying to decrease the levels allowed in water, even though they're only really doing that for 6 out of the 9,000. At least it's a start. The FDA is trying to do something by updating its MACRA, Modernization of Cosmetics Regulation Act, looking at how do we kind of enforce these product manufacturers to either list their ingredients, let us know if there are any issues with safety, and they're really trying to kind of make it more of a regulated environment for these cosmeceutical companies to really list their ingredients and whether or not there are adverse health issues with their ingredients. And that hopefully will be something that will help out. And of course, there are some issues, some bills coming out here and there. The No PFAS in Cosmetics Act that was introduced at the federal level, I think, is a little bit died, but who knows? But many states have passed their own bills, which has been very helpful. If you want to look into this more, Silent Spring Institute is really great. Look into that organization. It's actually a joint effort between Northeastern and Michigan State, and they're fantastic scientists that are really looking at this. And they helped create this app, which you can have on your phone called Clearia, it's really, really cool. I have it on mine. So if you want to look for waterproof mascara, say at Amazon, you put in waterproof mascara and you search, and say you want to click on this brand. When you do that, this little guy shows up. And if you click on it, if the product has its ingredients listed, which many don't, it will actually kind of tell you all of the issues with the ingredients in this product. And it'll tell you this is a PFAS. And so maybe you might not want to get it.
You can watch Dr. Huri present her case on the Stranger DX page of the DEF website at dermnppa.org. Now, we close out this episode with the Dermalorian Derm Decoder. In recognition of STD Awareness Week, Derm faculty member and dermatologist Dr. Ted Rosen shares tips on talking candidly to patients about STD prevention.
Now you've diagnosed an STD, what do you do? How do you approach the patient? So, of course, counseling is very important. Number one thing, most important, is don't be shy. You can't say, well, I don't feel comfortable talking about sexual proclivities or sexual practices. You have to just do it. And you can't hold back, or you may not teach the patient how to be better protected in the future. So speaking frankly, and if need be, graphically, about sex, sexual practices, and sexual diseases, sexually transmitted diseases, is very important.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dermalorian podcast from the Dermatology Education Foundation. If you're on the East Coast, we hope to see you next month at the East Coast Biologic and Small Molecule CME Bootcamp, being held May 3rd to 4th in Jersey City, New Jersey. You'll learn from our expert faculty, including Wendy Cantrell, David Cohen, Kara Gooding, Jamie Heim, Alexa Hetzel, Sandry Johnson, and Darren West. Get more details at dermnppa.org, and may the 4th be with you. Keep an eye out for new episodes of the Dermalorian podcast, posted monthly.